I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, but I just knew that I didn't want to do coaching. And so I was kind of looking at what else can you do if it's not coaching. I think a lot of young people at that age, especially that like football, all they see is coaching, but there's so many other roles you could do within a football club. I kind of found out about this thing called player care. Other people call it player liaison. But the way I see it is it's supporting the athlete off the field so that they can focus on their game on the field or on the court or, you know, on the golf course or whatever it may be. So we're not in it for the money, but we're in it because we want to see players just do well. And what matters is knowing that you supported someone in a dark moment and brought them kind of through that moment into the light. Especially young people, I always say, if I was a millionaire, you'd be listening to every word I say. Because I'm not a millionaire, you don't want to hear it, but I'm giving you £1 million worth of advice.
There's a myth that if you don't make it as an elite athlete, the only other career you can have to stay in sport is as a coach. My guest today, Jonathan, absolutely dispels this myth. He has done player care for Premier League clubs and now travels the world providing player care to up-and-coming tennis professionals. Tune in to discover a different route into sport. And guys, you know what to do. If you're liking the content, make sure to like, subscribe, share, comment. Now enjoy the show. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does, where we talk about what your best friends do, because let's face it, nobody knows. Today, I'm joined by my best friend, the player care consultant, Jonathan. How you doing, bro?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
Bro, thank you for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We like to start with a little icebreaker. Mm-hmm. What did you want to be growing up?
Do you know what's crazy? I wanted to be an IT consultant growing up.
Okay.
Don't ask me why. I just wanted to have my own IT company. Wanted to be an IT consultant, go around helping people fix stuff.
Okay.
That dream died quickly.
Yeah, I was about to, you call it a dream? I'm like, wow. I was expecting football. We had Spy the other week. Yeah. IT consultant, there's a first for everything on this podcast. Jonathan, you are special. I already know it. I love it. Okay, so you wanted to be an IT consultant.
Yeah.
You're now in player care. Mm-hmm. Let's go way back. Can you talk us through your upbringing, your education, and how you've kind of got to this point?
Grew up in a Caribbean household. Mum's from Barbados, dad's from Jamaica, and was just not educationally astute at all.
Okay.
Kind of was flopping in school, basically. And then kind of GCSEs came around, failed those miserably.
Oh, wow.
And obviously, as you do, you spend that whole summer crying your eyes out. Managed to kind of hustle my way into college. And from there, kind of, it was almost like the light bulb kind of flicked on, because I was now doing exactly what I wanted to do. I was studying sport and exercise. I was studying in Enfield College in North London, left there and went out to Hertfordshire and studied in Hertfordshire for 2 years and then made it to university.
Oh,
so I was at St. Mary's in Twickenham for 3 years.
What did you study?
So I studied a joint honours degree, so health and exercise and physical and sport education.
Okay.
So once I did that, I was at kind of a crossroads. It was either go to Loughborough, which is the university I'd always wanted to go to, or stay at my university at the time, St. Mary's, and study sports journalism.
Okay.
Decided to go to Loughborough, studied a master's in sport and business. Loved every minute of it, learned so much, met some amazing people. And then when I left, I ended up working at a pupil referral unit.
Oh, wow.
So I was working with some bad kids.
Yeah.
There's some crazy moments. We had kind of a boy stabbed in the school. We had kids kind of from rival areas coming with machetes to the front gate.
Wow.
It was really crazy stuff. But I was there for about 6 months, and then I ended up at Chelsea Football Club working in their schools department. So I was working with about 3,000 kids, basically trying to help them achieve their goals. But while I was there, I always knew that I wanted a little bit more. I knew I wanted to be kind of in the mix of the sport in action. And I kind of found out about this thing called player care. Other people call it player liaison or player support. Mm. And I applied for countless amounts of jobs at countless amounts of clubs, got so many rejections, even applied for the role at Chelsea, got rejected. But I kind of stuck with it, and one day got my opportunity to apply for Watford, and that was kind of the beginning of, I guess, my player care journey. I made it to Watford and spent about a year and 3 months at Watford working with their academy players, had some amazing times. Got to see the world in part, went to France for the first time, went to Poland, places like that. And now, having left Watford over a year ago, I now work for the International Tennis Federation, where I look after 20,000 professional tennis players on a day-to-day basis.
Wow. What an intro, can we just say. Let's take it back. You went to Loughborough. You did your master's there in sports and business, I believe it was.
Yeah.
When you're there, did you know like what the next step was? Like, had you started prepping? Because like you kind of just went over it, but like you did like people referral, like that's like a big switcher. How did that kind of come about?
Do you know what? I don't really know. Like at that time I was 22, 23, and I wasn't quite sure what the future held for me.
Okay.
Didn't even really know what I wanted to do. If anything, if I'm being honest, I probably thought I'd be an Olympic athlete or something. Like that. Do you know what I mean? But I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, but I just knew that I didn't want to do coaching. And so I was kind of looking at what else can you do if it's not a coach. And I think a lot of young people at that age, especially that like football, all they see is coaching, but there's so many other roles you can do within a football club.
Yeah.
Sorry
to jump in there. What was the first role you had at Chelsea? Because you were there for a bit.
So for the full 4 years that I was at Chelsea, I was basically a project officer.
Okay.
But the role was based within schools.
Okay.
So I ran Chelsea's initiatives within schools. In essence, in one sense, to, I guess, build a bond with the next generation of fans, you know, but then also to help the kids achieve their goals and their dreams and their aspirations. So I worked in two different schools. I worked in an academy and then I worked in an all-boys school, which, you know, the difference between the two is crazy when you kind of think of an all-boys school.
Yeah.
But so I spent a good 4 years there. To be honest, I didn't want to spend 4 years there. The initial contract was an 18-month contract, but we, like, the group that I was a part of, we did so well that they kept us on for more years.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
I love that. And they kept you on, but whilst you're there, you're applying for other things,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you mentioned the fact that you faced a lot of rejection.
Yeah.
Looking back now, what do you think it is that caused the rejection? Is it stereotyping? Is it a lack of experience? Because obviously you end up getting the role, right?
Yeah.
How did you feel during that period?
So during that period, it was tough because, you know, applying for the role of player care, especially within an academy, you're dealing with young people. And I felt like I had that knowledge of working with young people. But I think, a large part of it is the experience. You know, football is such a small world, but it's also a shut off, closed world as well. So if you haven't worked in a football club, it's quite hard to kind of just break through. And I think what helped is, you know, the not what you know, but who you know type of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm a massive believer in LinkedIn and using LinkedIn to network with people. And I linked in with the right person, that networked to the right person who at the time was working for Chelsea, but had previously worked for Watford as their first team player care officer.
Okay.
So he knew someone at Watford and he basically put in a good word for me. And I think they saw, along with, you know, his testimony of me, they saw the hard work I'd put in at Chelsea. And I guess I kind of got in that way.
Wow. So for the listener, for anybody, just going through that. So there's two things there. One is networking,
yeah.
Right? The power of networking, understanding that there are people who can open doors for you.
Yeah.
And then I'm hearing resilience as well,
yeah.
Because you faced a lot of pushback. In terms of finding the right person and then connecting with them, did you just search player care? Were you connecting with everybody from Chelsea?
So it's funny, like someone who I consider to be a mentor, one day he said to me, he's like, if people used LinkedIn the same way they used Instagram, they'd realize how much of a powerful tool it is.
Mm.
And so he said, what you should do is you should try to connect with at least 50 people a week. So like on the train home from work, while I'm eating my dinner, before I go to bed, like I'm on the train to work, I'm just trying to connect with people.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a case of like trying to find the right individual. It was just, I was having conversations with all types of people within the industry.
Yeah.
People that had just got a job in player care, I wanted to find out how you did it. people who had been in there for 5 years, I want to find out how you did it.
Yeah.
Some people responded, other people just, they blank reject you and don't respond. Yeah. But yeah, I guess from a resilience standpoint, I think I really realized that it took resilience when I went for the job at Chelsea, the club I was working for at the time, and I had an interview. I think I had two interviews and I got kind of the rejection, and that one really, really stung. Because yeah. I remember, you know, usually you get a phone call to say, oh yeah, you haven't got the job or whatever. I just got an email. Which, wow. If that's how you did, that's how you do it. I don't want to speak bad about the club or the organization, but that's how it happened for me.
Wow.
And that was the moment where I was just like, okay, do you know what? Like, I'm not going to let this one be the end of me. I'm just going to keep going. And literally the next one I applied for, I got.
Okay, sick. And yeah, you know, talking about that next one, which was Watford, like, how is it that you define player care?
So player care, it's a difficult thing to define really, but the way I see it is it's supporting the athlete off the field so that they can focus on their game on the field or on the court or, you know, on the golf course or whatever it may be. It's all about making sure that the athlete feels safe and secure in the environment that they're faced with, you know, both at work and not at work. But it's also about building a sense of resilience, but also a sense of understanding of themselves and the world around them. Mm-hmm. A lot of these athletes can be quite sheltered individuals, especially within football, when you've got people doing something for you all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas what I want to do, and I guess what player care officers around the country want to do, is build that sense of resilience and independence in players that when, you know, when the money stops coming in, when the game does stop, when you do hang up your boots or your gloves or whatever it may be, you can fend for yourself because you've got the knowledge and the experience as to how to do that, because you didn't have people wiping your bum the whole time, throughout your career.
I love that. So if we talk about Watford first and then we'll go into tennis.
Yeah.
So yeah, when you were at Watford, how would you describe like a typical day or a typical week in player care?
There, no 2 days are the same. You know, like you get to work at 9 o'clock and the boys have already been there for about half an hour, 45 minutes. They're in the change room listening to music and everything, in the physio room just having a laugh. You get in and I say you do your rounds. So you get in and you kind of say hi to all the boys. There'd be some boys there that, you know, English isn't their first language. So you try and have a little language lesson with them. So I learned a bit of Portuguese while I was there. So you go in, bom dia, tudo bem? You know, you have a conversation. You have a little conversation with them. And then, you know, you go back into the office, do a bit of paperwork for the morning. And then they have something called prehab. So the boys will go out and they'll go into, you know, whether it's the physio room or the gym or wherever, and they'll just do their stretches and their warm-ups for the day ahead.
Yeah.
And so part of my role was looking after the host families. So a lot of the boys came from far over the place. So just make sure that the hosts are okay, make sure that they're all paid on time and little things like that. And then a large part of it was kind of fighting fires when football wasn't happening. So when boys were in the lunch canteen, or, you know, when training had finished for the day and boys just want to have a chat, they just want to tell you about something that happened to them out on road, or they want to tell you about they're having issues with their girl or what have you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you get so many questions throughout the days, throughout the months and weeks and whatnot, that no 2 days are the same.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. So many questions come off the back of that. First, you know, what was the age group that you were dealing with?
So I dealt with under nines all the way to under 21s. So I had about 150 players in total.
Just insane numbers. Yeah. And like, how did the care differ, right? Because as you say, under nines, obviously they're very young. Parents probably parentally supervised a lot of the time. When I'm here in under 21s, these guys are probably on contracts earning serious money.
Yeah.
They don't want to hear it. Like, talk to me about how the care differed based on, like the different age groups.
Yeah, so when you're dealing with kind of under 9s, 10s, 11s, kind of the really younger boys, a lot of it is kind of teaching them just kind of how to be a little bit more mature. So some of the stuff you'll get is you might get some bullying that happens. Boys are kind of starting to kind of understand a little bit more about themselves and the world. On the odd occasion, you might get a bit of kind of racist behavior, so to speak. Just because you got to remember, all the boys are coming from different families. And if dad or mum's watching the TV and Saka misses a penalty, do you know what I mean? So you got to deal with some of that stuff. But then when you're dealing with kind of the under 18s, 19s, 21s and that, you're getting boys that are getting their first contracts. You know, so you sign your contract on a Monday, I come back to work on a Tuesday or the Wednesday, and I'm seeing, you know, A classes and wow. I'm seeing BMWs in the parking lot, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is football, isn't it?
Yeah.
But with the older boys, you know, you're basically a dad, do you know what I mean, or a big brother to them.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of things that they haven't experienced yet. Because if you think to get to that point in your career where you now have a professional contract, that's stemming from when you were like 7, 6 years old.
Yeah.
6 years old, you were the best footballer in your school and you signed a contract with Watford and you're going kind of through the rounds, through the age groups. You go to secondary school and you're probably the most looking, best looking boy. You're the fittest boy. You're the fastest boy in school. Do you know what I mean? So you're living a life where everyone adores you, yeah. where people worship you. You know, if you're not playing that week for the school team, they're like, why are you not playing? You know, people were kind of pandering to you. And so you have to kind of put the boys in their place sometimes and let them know that, look, I know you're the next big ticket, you're the next big thing, but you're also you bleed like the rest of us.
100%.
You get injured like the rest of us and your career can end like the rest of us. Do you know what I mean? So you have to put things into perspective because not everyone, even with a pro contract, not all of them make it.
Yeah, love that. And like as you said that there, there's two things that have come out to me. One is like, are you involved in aftercare? Because this sounds like pre-care,
yeah.
like whilst they're there.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, I watched, I think it's South of the River, mm-hmm. which was a documentary on BT Sport, and they spoke about like the need for increased aftercare. Mm-hmm. Does your role, or did your role constitute that as well? Or was that kind of a different team who would deal with those people that didn't end up making it?
Yeah, so aftercare was my kind of burden to deal with as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so... the good thing is the Premier League kind of brought in a rule that boys that had left the club needed to be supported by the club they'd left for about 3 years until they decided to leave football altogether or they found a new club and it was someone else's responsibility to look after them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I had boys who left the club injured, were injured for a year, 18 months, 2 years, and you still have to support them. And that's tough because all they want to do is play football.
Yeah.
And when you can't play football... what have you got? These are boys that have grown up saying, all I want to be is David Beckham. All I want to be is Ronaldo, you know?
How do you break through to people when that's their kind of mentality?
Do you know what the hardest thing is? The hardest thing is that you're a villain and you're a villain because you're a part of the organisation that broke their heart. So unless they can see past that, some boys leave and don't want anything to do with you because you're still attached to the club that broke their heart.
Yeah.
And so... you know, really and truthfully, all you can do is your best.
Yeah.
And if people don't want to answer the phone, if people don't want to come in for a chat or coffee, then they don't want to come in.
I hear that. And as you were like talking about like the day-to-day, doing the rounds, this, that and the other, like it sounded like you spent a lot of time with the boys. Like, is there like dedicated time where they're like, all right, this hour, a bit like school, it's player care hour where you ran like classes full with squads? Mm. Or was it just... you're about, like you said, like the big brother giving advice, or is it a bit of both?
So it's a bit of both. We had what's called life skills workshops. So we had independent providers that came in and provided, you know, sexual health classes. They provided kind of drug awareness, gambling awareness classes. And then there was, you know, we had our own office. So boys would kind of dip in and dip out and during lunchtime and they'd have chats with us and we'd crack jokes. And the space in general was meant to be a safe space for boys to feel relaxed and they come in and talk about anything. You know, we had boys that would say, like, I'm not talking to my mum. I haven't been talking to her for 2 weeks. And, you know, we wouldn't sugarcoat it. We'd tell the truth. She gave birth to you, bro. What are you doing?
Do you want to eat food?
Like, yeah, come on, man. We'd chat on a real kind of basic level because one thing that I believe in is that sometimes you have to tell the truth to these guys because if they do make it, there are going to be people that are lying to them all the time.
Yeah.
And I just want to be that person that, if they do come back or say, I need someone that's going to tell me the truth, they know where to find me.
Yeah, I love it. This has been so real already. And then just like, yeah, like on that, like, I suppose my question is, yeah, like when players make it or they don't, like, do you see a change in their personality is the first question.
Do you know what's funny? I mean, it depends on what we term as make it, because I think a lot of people say making it is, you know, you're playing for Tottenham or you're playing in the Premier League, you know, you're earning 10, 15, 20K a week. But, you know, I've just got a boy, Damani Hunter, shout out to Damani that I spoke to today, and he's playing kind of the lower leagues and he's like, but I love it. Do you know what I mean? I'm still living my dream. I might not be where I kind of could have been or wanted to be, but I'm living my dream. And so I think it depends on what making it is. I do see a difference because a lot of boys, especially when it's injury, a lot of boys kind of are regretful or a bit vengeful because they feel like they were pushed back into the game too soon or they felt like they didn't need the operation that they had or whatever. So it's difficult. I think it's dependent on the boys, the guy's mentality.
But spending so much time with these kids, yeah, like, did mentality, and this is tough like to say, did mentality like play a part in some of these kids making it versus not making it? Because, you know, you mentioned being vengeful, etc. Like, was it mentality? Like, could you see those who were going to make it versus those who were not going to make it?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You can definitely see it because those who make it, there's just a difference in their mindset. There's a difference in how they approach training. There's a difference in how they approach match preparation. Like, I'm talking, I came across boys who they're smoking weed during the week.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean? I've come across boys who they're out partying. They're on late nights seeing girls. And then I had other boys who are at home, in bed by 8 o'clock, feet up, resting their legs, icing down, doing the stretches, like literally living the lifestyle. And I think when you look at football now, that's kind of like the Ronaldo mentality of like every single day is my body getting ready to do something great.
Yeah.
And I think there are players that take care of their bodies and players that don't. When you've got players that are doing nitrous oxide on the weekend,
yeah, crazy.
You know, and you want to be a professional football player at the highest level, but you keep on getting injured, you've kind of got to ask yourself, why am I getting injured all the time? You know?
Yeah, mate, I love it. And spending so much time around, you know, professionals, aspiring professionals, would you say there's like any common misconceptions about footballers that people have?
Yeah, I think one of the common misconceptions is kind of that they keep on going. Like they're just kind of energy bunnies, you know what I mean? These guys break down. Like, they break down. I never forget, I had a really senior coach who had just finished playing Premier League football. He said, you'll spend, like, 3 weeks of the season fully fit.
Wow.
Like, for the entirety of the season, basically, you're injured. You've got niggles, you've got pains, you've got aches. And it's like, that's football. Do you know what I mean? Like, we kind of sit here and we say, like, these guys live a great life. They earn all the money, but they do make some crazy sacrifices.
There's a cost.
There's a cost. Like, that same coach said that for the 15-year career he had, when he had his wife and his kids, every Christmas Day he spent in a hotel away from them.
Yeah.
Because of Boxing Day games are massive. So if you imagine, like, you're a London football player and you're spending Christmas in a hotel in Newcastle away from your kids, like, the sacrifice is just different.
Yeah, it's true. The sacrifice is crazy, but give me the peas. Yeah. I'll go to the hotel. I'll go to the hotel for 20 years, for 25 years. I'll tell you that much.
I mean, if your wife is prepared to not see you every Christmas, then fine, isn't it?
Nah, I'm joking. But yeah, that takes us nicely into tennis, right? Yeah. So you come from, yeah, dealing with these footballers, you transition into tennis. Can you take us through, like, yeah, a typical day, week, or what it's like?
So tennis is a lot slower. It's a lot slower than football. It's a lot more, I wouldn't say it's laid back, but it's a lot more chilled than football. A typical day, I'll get in, and we've got a massive project going on right now. Because what we're trying to do is bring player care into tennis, and it's never been done before to the level we're trying to do it.
Okay.
So a typical day right now for me is I come in and I kind of answer my emails, have a chat with my manager and things like that. And then what I'm on now is resource development. So we're trying to develop resources for athletes so that they kind of understand maybe a little bit more about themselves, about their bodies, about, you know, what they need to do. But also they get information on little kind of tips and tricks about kind of even down to air travel.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with a lady that works for a kind of charter organization, And she was even telling me that, you know, some of the planes now, the fuselage is built different, that if you're sitting at the very back of the plane, you're less likely to get jet lag than if you're at the front.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I just thought, wow, that's interesting. But that's great for a player to know who's traveling across the world.
So they can request to sit at the back.
Exactly.
That's sick. And like you mentioned the fact that in football, it was under nines to under 21s. Like with tennis, how is it broken out?
So with tennis, it's kind of like 18 to 33, potentially 14 to 33, because in the women's game, female players progress a lot quicker. So we find 14-year-olds are playing on the pro tour.
Okay.
But in total, I look after 20,000 players.
My goodness.
we're talking kind of top, we're talking 250, rank 250 all the way down.
Okay, so it's not the best of the best. Not in that sense. They're still the best of the best.
Yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
like 250 upwards. Yeah. When I hear that, I'm thinking, how are they professionals? Like, do they make a living playing tennis?
So the difficult thing about tennis is that it's so hard to make a living. The players that I deal with, they're trying to get to that level where they're just breaking through. Do you know what I mean? And the prize money structure is quite crazy on the tour as well. A good film to watch if you haven't watched it is Challenger.
Is that the new one with Zendaya? So I've not seen it yet, but I definitely
okay, so check
it.
That out, because you kind of, some of the stuff in there, it's real. Yeah. Like, it really happens. But yeah, it's the prize money structure. If you know, if we both went to a W15 tournament, which would pay you 15K, you're not getting that 15K. That 15K is split between 75% goes to the main draw, so the singles players, and then the remaining percentage goes to the doubles players.
Wow.
So now, if you win a 15K tournament, you're looking at, as a singles player, you're coming out with maybe like $1,000.
Huh?
Yeah. And if you win a doubles tournament, you're coming out of 800, which has to be split between you and your doubles partner. So that's 400 each.
And these tournaments are played over a week?
These tournaments will be played over the course of like a week, 2 weeks.
So that means that, and like, we've not even spoken about the fact that they need to pay for coaches. We've not even spoken about the fact that they need to pay for rackets. We've not even spoken about the fact they ain't secured that Adidas sponsorship yet. So yeah. They ain't got their kit. They got to provide that. They're earning $1,000 every 2 weeks.
Yeah, we're talking about flights as well, accommodation, food.
So, like, what does that do for a player's mental?
So it's crazy, because it's a win for a player is so massive, because majority of tennis players will lose on tour.
Yeah.
Because that's just the nature of the game. It's you versus me, right?
Yeah.
But for their mentality, it does one of two things. What we find from research is that they just go harder. Do you know what I mean? It's just another reason to just grind out and try and try and try and try. You'll have players that are playing on the tour for... You literally have players who will work a part-time job or go back home and work a full-time job for a month or 2 months, pick up the pay and use that pay to then go abroad and play more tennis.
Wow.
Come back and do the same thing because it's their dream.
And how would you say, what is... how does the tennis athlete differ from the football athlete? Because you mentioned the fact that some of the footballers, they're smoking weed, they're doing this, they're doing that. It sounds like these tennis players, they don't even look like they've got money to do that. Yeah, so like, how does the interactions differ?
Yeah, it's very different, because it's a very different sport. I mean, no offence to the football players, but a lot of things are done for them, aren't they? You know, you don't have to worry about travel because the club's got that sorted, unless you're going abroad on a holiday. Do you know what I mean? For these tennis players, they are individuals, they're self-employed. This is, unless you've got a team, this is you on your lonesome doing it all yourself. You know, you've got to find the flights. You know, if you think a tennis player who's losing 6-4, 6-3 in that final set, their mind's not on winning this final set necessarily. Some players it will be, but some other players it's, okay, so once I lose this, I need to go back to the hotel, I need to pack my bags, and I need to head on the next flight out of here to the next tournament.
Yeah.
Some players will bring their bags to the tournament packed in case they lose, because they know from there I can head straight to the airport and pick up a flight. Like, tennis at this level is the wild, wild west, literally.
And from what you can see, like, is enough being done to support those players? Obviously, you've been you've been hired. You've got these ongoing initiatives. Like, is it sustainable for these people 250 and above? It's a tough question as well.
It's tough. Like, I mean, I'd say no, it's not sustainable. But then if it wasn't, we wouldn't have the game.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And it's hard because it's almost like a pyramid system.
Yeah.
Like,
you need those players.
You need those players because those players then help produce Alcaraz, help produce, you know, Coco Gauff. You know what I mean? You need that, which is sad because it means that, you know, tennis, I always say tennis is, you know, the 1% we see on TV isn't the real deal. Mm. You're seeing the best of the best. You're seeing the Adidas sponsorships, like you said. The 99% of tennis players are the ones that are really out there suffering, finding it hard. And those are the ones that my task is to support, the 99 who don't get all the opportunities. But hopefully we can do something that provides an opportunity for them.
Do you feel like the 6 months you spent in the people referral unit helped to prepare you well for the different types of athletes you've dealt with?
Yeah, because I'm not surprised at anything I see now. Yeah. Like, I'm not surprised. Like, I've seen kids that, you know, they leave the school and they're heading in you know, these big flash cars because they're being sexually exploited. Like, wow. I've seen, like, a real deal happen in a community that's not too far from my own community. Do you know what I mean? And so now when I step into a football club or when I step in, you know, into a tournament, a tennis tournament, and I hear some things that happen or go on the tours or in change rooms and stuff, like, I'm not really surprised because, you know, I guess life is difficult for everybody. Do you know what I mean? Even if you're a football player, you're affected by the cost of living in some way. Mm. Even though you got the millions, you're still affected because things are more expensive. Yeah. Everyone's basically trying to catch a bone, you know? And I guess it's helped me, that experience, because now I know that I have to be innovative in how I support people. You know, it can't just be, you know, here's a resource, read it. It can't just be, oh, pick up the phone and call this person. Like, you have to really put effort into supporting these people,
yeah,
because, you know, they're young football players that really need help. And there are grown men and women in their 30s who are struggling on an international tour. Like, you have to really be, you know, you have to diversify how you support players.
Okay, my next question, like, it sounds like you're so passionate about what you do and, like, you've obviously got a lot of experience. Is there, like, any qualifications to become, like, a professional player care consultant?
Well, player care is, like, quite new to the industry. Hugo Schechter, who is kind of, like, we kind of call him the player care guru, you know, he devised a player care course. His organization is called the Player Care Group.
Okay.
And right now, that's kind of like the gold standard of player care. And a lot of people are taking his course and they're getting player care opportunities in various different, you know, sports, but mainly football. And so, you know, there are university degrees now. There are master's degrees in player care. So there's a lot that's going out there now. But again, this is an industry that's within sport that's very young. Mm. But we can see that it's massive because you'll have Premier League coaches who talk about mental health support for players.
Mm.
And that's why we're here. We're here to support players. The Premier League put an initiative in that all academies, I think at category 1, 2, and 3, have to have a player care officer. So that's a large percentage of the 92 clubs in the whole football structure that have that have me in there now.
Yeah, and is it just one person per club? Or?
So no, it's some people. When I was at Watford, we had one person. It was just me. Chelsea, I think, have quite a few. Arsenal have quite a few. You know, it depends on the size of the club.
Okay, okay. And you mentioned Hugo Schechter there. For anybody who's listening to this and they're like, oh my God, like, I don't have to be a coach.
Mm-hmm.
I can get into player care. Like, what would your key piece of advice for anybody considering, like, an alternative to coaching?
My bits of advice would firstly kind of be to kind of network, you know. That's how I got where I am. Network. LinkedIn is gold. It's the key. But I'd also say, try and understand what your values are. And whenever you do have an interview or do get an opportunity to speak in front of a panel who are looking to select you for a job,
yeah,
ask them what the club's values are. Because I think it's really important that the two values match up. Because if they don't, it won't work. Player care is very people focused. And as people, we have our own beliefs and ideologies. And if your ideologies don't match up with the club or even with the manager's ideologies, then you're going to butt heads quite a bit.
And, you know, you mentioned manager there. Like, football is a very volatile game, right? Mm. You know, we've seen we're seeing Pochettino has just like shockingly left Chelsea.
Yeah.
When there's a change in management, considering the role, is your job on the line? Like, because might a manager bring in their own player care people, or is it safe?
So your job is safe. Normally your job is safe. Like at Watford. So thankfully, obviously at Watford.
Because Watford, they used to fire managers like there was no tomorrow.
So the good thing is obviously being in the academy, your job's safe. And even if you're in the first team, your job's safe.
Okay.
But you can imagine the difficulty. When I was at Watford, if I remember correctly, I saw five or six different managers in 1 year at Watford.
Wow.
So you can imagine. And the problem, my job is safe, but the parameters of my job changed slightly with each manager. Roy Hodgson, you know, he brought a couple of our boys up to the first team. You know, Slaven Bilic, he brought some boys to the first team. But then there are other coaches who, you know, youth development really isn't their thing, you know.
So you're dealing with a lot more depression.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Because boys don't feel like they've got an opportunity.
Exactly. So, mad. You know, even though you're kind of the building across from the first team, you're still affected in some type of way.
Okay. And then my other question, like, you know, hopefully the people who are listening to this podcast, they're quite ambitious. Like, they get into player care. Maybe they want more than player care.
Mm-hmm.
Once you're in the club, is it easy to move between roles? And like, yeah, like, how do you progress, I suppose, would be the question. Mm. I know it's still new, so yeah, maybe there is, it hasn't been forged yet, but just in case.
I mean, progression... it's difficult because I think, you know, in bigger clubs, progression is probably a little bit easier, which is weird to say.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what I've seen people have more success in is going from one club to another.
Okay.
And finding success that way.
Okay.
You know, I know a couple of people that have been at, you know, lower league clubs and then they've moved on to academy they've moved on to player care manager in the academy in another club.
Okay.
And, you know, I guess the closer you get to those types of positions, the general next step is to either kind of transition into first team football player care or women's football player care.
Okay. Sick. And, you obviously deal with people from all backgrounds, like you've said. What would you say the most stressful part of being in player care is?
The most stressful part of being in player care, from my experience, has definitely been... It's been dealing with boys from my own community, actually.
Wow.
And the reason being is because I know exactly the type of kind of traps that are out there for them.
Yeah.
And they fall into them time and time again. And it's difficult because you know exactly where they've been, you know exactly what they've done. And it's just trying to get them to understand, like, look, this pathway is not going to serve you any good. It's not going to help you.
Yeah.
But I guess... the trappings of life, yeah, out there are just too lucrative, too nice for them.
But it's so crazy that you say that, because if you've made it to an academy, you're almost seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. So why is it, you know, that the kids look at those things as so shiny?
Because I think football is good in a sense where it can take a boy away from his friends that aren't doing anything with their lives.
Yeah.
That's the good thing about football. But then the boys miss that because it's their boys, it's their friends.
Yeah.
And I always say to especially young people, I always say, like, if I was a millionaire, you'd be listening to every word I say. Because I'm not a millionaire, you don't want to hear it. But I'm giving you £1 million worth of advice.
Mm.
And that's the thing. Like, you can take the horse to the water, but you can't make it drink.
You got so many phrases. I love it. We've spoken about, yeah, what you consider the most stressful part to be. What would you say is the most rewarding aspect of player care?
The most rewarding part is when you see the players succeed in tennis, in football, when you see them succeed, when you see them, you know, come back from a long injury and they score their first goal. Best thing I can give you is I had a player, Toby Adeyemo. And he was given his first league debut, his first league match by Slaven Bilic.
Yeah.
Toby was 17, came on with 60 minutes. I think we were playing Blackpool at the time. Ball goes, one of the players shoots, ball rebounds. Toby spins and shoots and scores.
Wow.
I think he became the fifth or sixth youngest Watford player to score in history. And that was just crazy because I got to see him kind of getting on the bus and going to the match. I got to see him on the field score, and then I got to chat to him hours later at 11 at night. Yeah. And he said to me, he's like, Jono, like, what have I just done? And I was like, bro, you made history, man.
Yeah.
Like, this is the beginning. And, you know, he was just at such a young age, at 17, I can't even imagine what I was doing. I was probably playing park football.
Yeah.
At 17, he's just scored in front of 20 plus thousand
yeah.
in the championship and won his team the game.
Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of, that's the good side when you see those moments and you know that it wasn't me that scored, but he scored that goal for all of us. Yeah, do you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah. And how do I phrase this next one? I think the first thing I'll say is around the player care role. So what are skills that you notice amongst all of the best player care people that you've dealt with?
It's, I think the best skill is kind of the empathy. You have this empathy for players, for athletes. You want to see them succeed. You want to make sure that they're well. That's the best skill that I've seen, because there are individuals who aren't empathetic. And you can see that the players don't take a liking to them, because the players want to feel like you genuinely care. And if you can show that you care about them, you know, we're not in it for the money. You know, player care isn't paying, you know, 100K a year, you know. So we're not in it for the money, but we're in it because we want to see players just do well.
Mm.
And what matters is knowing that you supported someone in a dark moment and brought them kind of through that moment into the light. And they went on, whether or not they stayed at your club or in your organization, they went on to do great things, and you were a part of that.
Yeah. You mentioned there that, you know, player care people, they're not in it for the money. Do you feel like for people who are considering the role, that's a consideration they need to take? Like, do you feel like fairly compensated for what you do?
I mean, it's just like any other role though, isn't it? Like, I guess team operations managers can say the same thing. Are they fairly compensated for the role? Don't get me wrong. Do I feel like, you know, those support roles deserve to be paid more? Yeah, 100%. I'm not just saying it because, you know, I've been in that game. I'm saying it because, yeah, they do.
There's value there.
There's
you
value
bring,
there.
Right?
Do you know what I mean?
The million pound advice. Like
exactly.
Said,
like, how many players would have committed suicide or gone through real tragedy if it wasn't for a player care officer, manager, support staff in that club doing what they did to support that player? You know, so I definitely think that we should be compensated better. But at the end of the day, kind of the compensation isn't the kind of main thing. The main thing is making sure that players are just safe.
I love that. And in terms of like success in player care, like how is it you're targeted? Like, you know, you've mentioned the fact they're saving lives, giving advice. Do you have like tangible KPIs that you're tracked against by the clubs or the tennis federation?
So when I was at Watford, no, there wasn't really any tangible KPIs. I think now at the International Tennis Federation, yes, it's basically creating like this project that we're doing. It's creating this program that supports players, that really highlights to players that we care, that the organization cares, and that tennis cares about them.
Yeah.
So yeah, the KPIs are kind of, you know, literally to kind of create a bank of resources to, you know, to do stuff like this, to get podcasts out there with players on them who are going to share their experiences, to set up a mental health 24/7 mental health service line. These are kind of like the KPIs that we're looking at, and you know, we started a year ago and we're kind of making steady progress, but time will tell. But yeah, those are kind of what we're looking at.
Yeah, I love it. Would you say you've got a good work-life balance with what you do? Player care sounds pretty 24/7, because they could call you, you mentioned they called you at 11 o'clock at
yeah,
night.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My work phone would be off. You ain't calling me at 11.
So do you know what? Like, football, there's never a day off in football. That's what you always hear when you get into football. There's never a day off. And so when I was in football, it was literally 24/7. I remember there was an incident that I had to deal with some coaches. And it's me going from, you know, where I live in North London, driving to St. Albans at kind of 11 at night to sort out this issue. Didn't get home until like 1 in the morning the next night. The good thing is my manager gave me the next day off. So that was nice. But the work-life balance in football is difficult because you're traveling all the time. You're traveling weekly. If you're a massive part or fixturing a team, you're traveling everywhere with the players, traveling abroad as well. But again, you know, from the end of May till kind of August, you kind of got time off. You know, you're chilling really. Tennis, you know, it's not as kind of day to day as football is. You know, it's more for me right now. My current role is to travel. You know, I travel an hour in the morning to work, but I travel 2 hours home. So the travel kind of eats at me. But then there are opportunities to chill out and to relax, and it goes in peaks and troughs, you know. So there are really busy times. Like right now is the busiest time because we've got the French Open, the Olympics, we've got Wimbledon coming up. But then after Wimbledon, it kind of slows down before the US Open.
And during, like, you know, these busy times, what is it specifically that keeps you up? Is it, oh my God, we've got so many people who are getting knocked out and they're depressed. Like, what is it that your focus is during, yeah, all of these key tournaments?
So I think it's mainly the focus throughout the year. The focus throughout the year is making sure that players are supported.
Okay.
So even like during Christmas times where it's quiet, players still need to be supported. You know, the players just don't stop thinking about tennis. Everything they do is tennis related. And sometimes we want to take them away from that and just let them understand that, you know, tennis isn't the be all and end all. You can't die for the sport, you know, because you are a number, you know, you're one of 20,000 that we deal with on the World Tennis Tour.
You mentioned the fact that, you know, at Watford, you did the rounds. How do you do the rounds at tennis? Is it phone calls?
Yeah, so it's phone calls, but again, you can't call
20,000 people.
I don't even know 1,000 people, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so it's a lot harder. It's, when information comes to you about players that are in distress, you deal with it that way.
Okay.
It's checking in on players that, you know, have just gone through a difficult situation and are at the other end.
Okay.
You know, you have conversations with them, but in essence, it's making yourself available to everybody. You know, we're not at that point yet where I've got even 2,000 people calling me yet. You know, we're still quite under wraps of what we're trying to do because we want to phase it in slowly.
Yeah.
But we do know a time will come where there'll be not just me in the department, there'll be 4, 5, 6 of me doing the same job in different areas because that's what will be needed.
That's it. And I feel like a question that the listener will have, it might sound silly, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Sure.
Do you need to have either a knowledge or the ability in the sport where you're offering player care? So, like, do you need to be good at football? Do you need to be good at tennis? Do you need to have knowledge? Like, could you get the job if you didn't know who Alcaraz was, as an example?
Yeah, yeah. you don't need any knowledge, any skill. You know what? People do ask you to have a little bit of knowledge, but the reality of it is like I always say to people, as long as you care. Like, I came into tennis thinking, oh, Wimbledon, Rafa Nadal, realizing that Wimbledon is just like
one of four grand slams.
Yeah. It's a minute detail in the grand scheme of tennis, you know. Same with football. Like, obviously, I knew football, watched football my entire life, loved football. Did I play football at a high level? No. You know what I mean? I played football for my school team, and that was about it.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't necessarily need to know the sport. You know, my kind of, I'm someone who I want to be able to try different sports, and once, you know, I've achieved what I want to achieve in tennis, I'm thinking, what's next? It could be rugby, it could be golf, it could be Formula One.
Mm.
Haven't got a clue about those sports. But at the end of the day, it's my experience working with an athlete. That's the most important thing. My love for helping athletes, that's the key thing. The experience is an add-on. You know, knowing about a scrum in rugby is an add-on.
Yeah.
But does knowing about a scrum make me a better player care officer? No, it doesn't.
As you talk about player care, do you think, like, you could go from player care into, like, performance coaching?
Yeah, I think you could. I think there you'd need some knowledge and some skill involved in that, because I think that game is very different to player care.
Okay.
You know, my side of player care, yes, we're looking at the athlete, but we're looking at performance lifestyle. So how your lifestyle can contribute to your performance.
Okay.
But I think, you know, if you're looking at solely performance, I think you do need to have that education and that awareness around that.
Yeah, okay, I love that. 20,000 tennis players is an insane amount. I couldn't picture 20,000 people in this building. Like, do you have any productivity hacks? How do you remain productive?
You know, the key thing for me is, you know, I've come from a work life where I was up on my feet a lot. I was clocking in like 30,000 steps at Watford. Yeah. And I'm now at a point where I'm clocking up like 5,000.
Yeah.
Because I'm sat at a desk. my performance hacks really are taking short breaks. I'll take like a 5 minute break, a 10 minute break. I'll kind of go to the toilet, get some water, go for a walk around the building. I'll go to my car, do you know what I mean? Anything to disengage so that when I can come back, I'm fully engaged again.
Yeah.
Because one thing you realize, and my work pattern is slightly different. I start work at 7 a.m. and I finish at 3 because the commute home is so mad.
Yeah.
So like I'm up when no one else is up. You know
how
what I mean?
Is that?
Do you know what? It's coming up to summer now, so it's good.
Yeah.
Because I'm getting up in the morning and you know, when it's earlier, people getting out a little bit, you know, when it's lighter, people are getting out a little bit earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
It hurts when it's like winter. And it's crazy because you kind of wake up in the morning and it's pitch black.
Yeah.
And so there's something about the light makes you tired.
100%.
So when I get to work in the winter at 7 and I have to nap in the car. So the winter just gone. I had a blanket and a pillow in the car.
Wow.
And so I just reclined the seat all the way back and yeah. I just fall asleep for half an hour
and then
head in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the breaks are really important just for your mind. And what I'd also say is, even though my role is 24 hours, basically, the minute you step into that car, all the worries of work have to go.
Yeah.
Like you have to try. Even though players might be ringing you and you do have to deal with those situations, that drive home has to be your space.
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, that's your opportunity to just be yourself, to, you know, sing your Madonna in the car or whatever you do.
Yeah.
It's important to have that time away from the game because, you know, we suffer as well.
and on that, it's amazing that you say that. Like, how else do you unwind? So you've mentioned singing Madonna in the car. What else?
Not specifically Madonna, but. I like to unwind. So I do a lot of stuff in my community. I help run a youth club and a food bank.
Oh, wow.
So that's just great to help people in your local community that are really in need. That's nice. I like to do a bit of public speaking as well. That's kind of like a real buzz for me. So opportunities like this to talk in front of a camera or in front of people, I absolutely love it. Those are the ways that I unwind.
Okay,
like I find it nice. You know, I watch sport. I try and stay away from the sport I'm working in only because, you know, when I was working in football, I really fell out of love with football because I kind of saw what it did to players.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit the same with tennis. Like I struggle to watch the big matches in tennis because I sit there and I'm like, it's not the real tennis.
This is
fancy tennis.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, there's the gutter over here that we're dealing with.
It's like the cages.
So, but yeah, yeah.
Okay. Sick. And then, bro, like where is it you see yourself in the next 5 and 10 years?
Oh man, it's tough because I think about kind of my journey in play care, and it's weird because it was such a long journey to get here, and it's that weird one where it's a long journey to get here and it won't be a long journey to stay in it.
Yeah.
You know, I think I've achieved the goal that I wanted to achieve. I've made it higher than I thought I'd ever make it in play care. And I think if the next step is, you know, moving up to a higher level of player care, then fine. But I think, you know, if I'm going to be myself and speak about ambition and everything, my next kind of move, I guess, wouldn't be in player care. It'd be in, you know, some form of broadcasting.
Oh, sick.
So I volunteer in radio.
Okay.
I host a show twice a week. And so my dream, you know, remember when I said when I was at Loughborough, before I got to Loughborough, it was going to Loughborough or sports journalism.
Yeah.
That sports journalism itch has to be scratched,
okay.
You know? So I'm kind of ripping up the rule book here, really, kind of putting away the degree and potentially focusing on something else in the near future.
Oh, bro, you got to.
Yeah.
Bro, like, do what makes you happy, bro, because that's what you'll be able to do for longest.
Exactly.
I know, talking to you off camera as well, you mentioned the fact that in your spare time, you've got like a mental health podcast.
Yeah.
Do you want to just like talk a little bit about that?
I can't really plug it because I've been lazy with it, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah, the main focus is called The Other Side. And the main focus is kind of looking at the other side of the sporting industry and other kind of industries and looking at the mental health implications of that. So if we're using tennis as an example, what's it like to be a tennis player and you see, you know, your counterparts earning millions upon millions and, you know, you're scraping through with a grand each tournament, you know, looking at the mental health side of dealing with being a GP and, you know, we're hearing kind of junior doctor strikes again, you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
dealing with the implications of those things and running your own business and things like that. So, yeah.
That sounds sick. Yeah. So please pick that back up so I can listen, bro.
Sure.
This has been such a sick conversation. Before we get into the quick fire round, just any final bits of advice for the listener that you feel like you want to impart?
Do you know what? So it's funny, like I thought about this question because I was like, oh, I know you're going to bring this up. So let me think about it. And it's funny, like, you know, I turned 30 this year, and alongside with the gray hairs that I'm getting now, one of the things that I used to say back in the day when people said, oh, what advice would you give to people? I always used to say, like, you need to be prepared to do what others aren't prepared to do to get to where others can't get to.
Yeah.
And as I've grown up, I've realized something that, you know, we live in a society where everything has to be about power, strength, bully your opponent. And sometimes we need to take a step back and just be grateful. So what I say on my radio show when I close it out every single week, I say, if you woke up this morning, you've got something to be grateful for. And I always think, and we always hear, that the richest place on the planet is the graveyard. Because that's where everyone's dreams, aspirations, hopes, the cures for cancer, etc., went to die. And so for me, it's really, I'm just grateful for the fact that I've got these opportunities to be in player care, got these opportunities to do radio and podcasts and stuff like that. So that's my biggest advice to people. Like, if you wake up in the morning, just be grateful for the fact that you can try all over again.
You see the empathy there. You can see why it's good. You can see why it's good at playing care. Jonathan, bro, this has been such a sick convo. No, are you ready for a quick fire?
Let's go.
Favorite sport?
Track and field.
Work with rookies or work with vets?
Rookies.
Money or happiness?
Happiness.
Would you rather handle a stressful or routine task?
Stressful task.
Work from home or work from the office?
Work from home, I won't lie.
Team unity or player satisfaction?
Team unity.
Yeah. Would you rather travel to the past or future?
To the past.
Who has it easier, men or women?
Men have it easier all day long.
Yeah. And then finally, dream dinner guest.
Yeah, dream.
Sit back in the chair for that one.
Dream dinner guest, because you know there's a few.
Who came to mind first as I said it?
I won't lie, Jesus.
Okay. Hey. Jesus, take the wheel.
I won't lie.
I love it. And fun fact, you're not the first person to say it.
Oh, really?
Although the last person who said it by mistake. She was like, Jesus. I was like, oh, there it is. It's Jesus. Jonathan, this has been such a sick conversation. We do have a closing tradition on this podcast. Knowing everything you know now, what advice would you give your younger self, and would you still be doing the same thing?
Knowing what I know now, the advice I'd give my younger self would probably be keep trying. You know, I went through that period where I was trying for jobs left, right, and center and couldn't get anywhere in even education in secondary school and primary age. Just keep trying, you know, because you'll find it. You know, you'll mature, you'll find it. And when you find it, you'll absolutely love it. And yeah, knowing what I know now, I'd go the same route all over again. I'd go through the heartache, the pain. I wouldn't change anything because I'm a firm believer if you change something, I guess it's almost like a movie sci-fi type of thing.
Yeah.
Back to the future type. If you change something, you just don't know what, that little fork in the road, you don't know what happens if you change it.
And you're grateful for where you are.
And I'm grateful for being here.
Oh, Jonathan, bro. Do you want to plug any socials?
Nah, do you know what? Apart from my LinkedIn, Jonathan Reed, that's it. I know there's quite a few Jonathan Reeds out there, so you got to be careful.
yeah, there is. We've got a funny story about that, but we'll save that for another episode. Jonathan, this has been such a sick conversation. And to the listener, if you've made it this far, you know what to do. Like, subscribe, share, comment. Let us know who you want to hear from. I know you didn't know you was going to hear from a player care consultant, but look, I did it. I keep pulling it out the bag. This has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. If you didn't know, now you know. Over and out.